Time to take a look at the health of your personal computer with Peter Greed of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Peter, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Always great, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Was Santa Claus good to you this year? And
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, anything in the computer line? Are you pretty much take care of all that yourself?
Well, my wife got an iPod.
Oh,
that's new for her. That's a challenge.
Yeah. Are they difficult to use?
It's not difficult to use. It's almost the Nano is so small and the video is so clear. It's pretty phenomenal device. My kids want, the iPhone. And I said, we're going to wait another year on that one.
See what happens with it. Well, John in Milwaukee has a question for you. So let's go to John. John, hi.
Hi. On PCs, there's a way that you can put it in a standby mode where all the power virtually goes off, so it's saving energy.
Right.
And I've used that on quite a few occasions, and it seems to pop back up and turn itself back on. And I looked in the syslogs, and I was trying to figure out what application was kicking it back on. And I'm wondering, I couldn't find anything in the syslogs, and I was wondering if there's anything that, any tools or utilities that are out there that allow you to identify why it came out of the standby mode.
Well, a couple of things. Are you hooked up to the internet with that system, like a broadband connection?
Yes, I am. But there are some nights where it'll go all night without turning on. Mm-hmm. So that's what's confusing me.
Mm-hmm. Depending upon applications you have on it, might be a timed update that it's looking for. That could be one thing. There could be, if you have any kind of messaging turned on. It could be
sure. No, yeah. I'm thinking about all those too. But I was mm-hmm. I was trying to identify it. I would think I'm not the only one who has this problem. And I think there's a tool of some kind that must. And I'm surprised that Microsoft didn't put that into the syslog that they would tell you why they woke up.
Yeah, yeah. They still want to make things a little bit difficult for us users.
Uh-huh.
You should probably be able to find a utility pretty easily. If you went to some of the popular sites like CNET.com, their download.com is a popular site, Simtel, Simtel.com. And just, even using Google and doing a search for some of those tools that I know they're out there. I used one. I try these things, and then my interest kind of wanes on some of the stuff.
Sure.
So I try it. It works, and I go, oh, that's neat.
Oh, I was going to make a suggestion. I just went out last week, and I bought a Nokia N800, which is similar to, like, the iPod thing, only it does internet and everything over Wi-Fi. And I was surprised there actually are applications where you can use it to call out. But it's not a cell phone per se. There are applications that allow you while you're on Wi-Fi to actually call landline phone numbers. And you can. There was the application that I saw with this N800 allows you to actually get a receiving phone number so that people can call you, and the N800 will ring as long as you're within a Wi-Fi area. So your kids might want something like that or look up that application.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. I remember when it was not available yet and it was put out on Nokia's site to, promote that it's coming. So it's one of those high-tech toys that's here and now.
Yeah.
Thanks, John. I wish we could be more help, but do some searching and see what you come up with. Let us know.
Yeah. Larry, you brought up a good question about what is a botnet, and it's the computeries or the jargon for that term are software robots, and some of them are actually good, believe it or not. So botnet doesn't mean that it's bad. Good applications are companies that use it for user support, online gaming, statistics. You know, if you look at the statistics for Major League Baseball, hockey, football, you know, on and on and on. I mean, those are the kind of things that need to be around all the time, grabbing all these feeds of information, you know, and manipulating them so it becomes useful. You know, the data becomes useful information for us to have access to. But there are bad ones out there. And unfortunately, the people that write, that are hackers that write the worms, the Trojans, the backdoor applications, can kidnap or, you know, grab hold of a system and use its resources to run their botnets to do their work, their bad work.
Oh.
So, you know, how do you prevent stuff like that? Well, some basic things. It used to be, you know, if you just shut down your web services on a server, so you could have a server online but not have access to web services, then there's really nothing it could do for a remotely, you know, set up botnet because it can't do anything. But, you know, if you if you stop network shares on your drive, you really shouldn't have any because, you know, you purposely go and set those up. But if you don't know what you're doing, you can set them up and not realize that you're giving someone remote access to your hard drive.
No.
So I always recommend, and we've talked about this on past shows, that if you're going to share something on your hard drive, share a folder, you know, and call it, shared folder or whatever you want to call it, but don't, you know, put things in there unless you want them shared. Typically, that might be music or it might be an important document that, you know, maybe people in the family are contributing to for a family newsletter or something like that. The other thing is, you know, setting up a firewall can be a bit tricky. So if you're going to set up a firewall, which can stymie botnets very easily, it could also stymie other programs. It could frustrate the end user in that certain things won't work. So, you know, typically something like McAfee or Norton that have these internet suites and they have these firewalls, you know, if you answer, you know, yes, sometimes to blocking your Internet Explorer browser, then you're not going to be able to get out and browse the web. So you need to pay attention to when you invoke these firewalls as to what you're turning on and turning off. Another interesting thing in terms of routers is there are a lot more controls in routers today than there used to be. So routers can have a hardware firewall built into the router, password protection, and so forth. But some real simple things like when you set up your router, don't leave the administrative password the default password, because then if someone does get in, and they go and try and change it, then they can, you know, manipulate your router without you knowing it. So, you know, one of the first things you should do is change the default password on your router to something that you know that no one else does. And then an SSID, which is a broadcast identification for your wireless network, I usually tell people, you know, put something that doesn't make sense for you, for the outside world to identify you. Like, don't put your address, you know, as an SSID, and they're going to know, oh, of course, that's where, you know, someone's living, you know, and, you know, that it's right there. I can point to it. You know, and don't use, like, a pet name or something. Use something that's, you know, off the wall that you would know but no one else would. Mm-hmm. And then as far as encryption, you know, again, that's a good thing and it's a bad thing. For some people, you know, using wireless encryption, it works, but it can also frustrate certain applications. You know, in other words, it can make certain applications not work correctly or not work at all. So, you know, it's an as-you-go kind of thing where for some people it works well and for others it doesn't. And then the other thing is with wireless routers and access points in homes and online gaming and things like this that people are doing now, you know, when they say it, the signal travels through a wall, that's like from, you know, one side to the other. It can go through a concrete wall, but if you look at it from an angle where it's going, and I'm showing Larry in the studio, where your access point is down on the floor, and you know the way it needs to come out is all the way at the very top of the wall, that distance is no longer, you know, 6 inches. It's more like, you know, could be 100, 200 feet, and the signal gets weakened that way. So positioning things for better, you know, accessibility and transmission will eliminate frustration, you know, for people that are setting those things up too.
We've got Michelle online, Pete, who wants to talk to you from Black River Falls. So let's go there. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have actually a hardware question. I have a printer problem, and every time I go to print with my black cartridge, it tells me that I need to remove the blue tape, and there is no blue tape. I've tried switching out many different cartridges, brand new cartridges, and I've tried cleaning, you know, clicking to clean to fix horizontal streaks, but it just streaks every time I try to use black ink. If I switch and I click it to just use color ink, it's just fine.
What kind of printer is it? What brand?
It's a Dell.
Okay. Have you tried, you know, usually what I do when I have problems with printers, sometimes, you know, with the interaction with the computer, sometimes it's something like downloading new device drivers.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, is it like one of those all-in-one printers where you can do copying and so forth?
Yes.
Are you having the problem where you try to do the copies and it still, you know, gives you bad gives you bad output?
Yes.
Have you tried contacting them at all?
I have, and they were no help whatsoever.
You know, I don't use a lot of Dell printers, but are they, when you buy the cartridge, does it look like it has the entire, so I guess I'll explain the difference. The Epson printers typically have just ink. The HP printers typically have the entire print mechanism along with the ink, so they look a little bit more bulky.
Uh-huh.
In size.
Uh-huh.
Is the ink cartridges for your printer really thin, or are they like bulky in size?
They're pretty thin.
Okay. You know, have you tried to look and see if there's a way for cleaning?
Yes. Okay. I've even, you know, tried blowing it with air. I've tried Q-tips with a little bit of alcohol. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see anything on there.
Why?
The only other suggestion, I've gone through so many of these printers, it frustrates me when I, you know, I just move one into my basement because I just can't take the heart to throw it out. You know, you look at them and they still look good, you know, but they don't work. I would probably do a search on, like, the Google forums, Google groups.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've done that before.
Uh-uh.
And try and describe your problem, you know, within, I'd say, 5 to 10 words.
Uh-huh.
And see what kind of results you come up with. You may have to do a little prying, but there might be someone out there that, you know, has a solution to offer to you.
Okay.
I know printing problems can be real frustrating. It might be something is, you know, did you run any labels or anything that might be sticky through them? Where
I did do labels at Christmas time.
Yeah, that can cause a problem where there's some residual left behind from the labels.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't see that's still there. That's you know, adding some extra friction and you know, causing the problem.
Even
though they say the labels are specific for inkjets or for laser printers,
uh-huh.
It's not 100% guarantee that you're not going to have that one label that lifts up and happens to grab on or happen to get folded when it got inserted into the printer and then causes the problem.
Okay. Yeah.
So worth a try.
All right. It's,
the problem's probably in the same place all the time.
Yes, it is.
So that gives you a clue right there where to be looking. So now you might need to take a little magnifying glass to get in there and see if you can try and find it.
Good luck, Michelle. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant with us today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking computers with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. We'll go right back to the phones and to Jared in Fitchburg next. Jared, hi.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
Hi. Before I ask my question, I think I have a possible idea for the first caller. My computer wakes up when a truck goes by because it wiggles the mouse. And that sometimes is enough to get it going. Or if somebody walks real hard in this...
Interesting, the vibration.
Yeah, sleazy floored unit that we live in. That does it too, so that's a possibility. I find it waking up all the time because of that. Anyway, my question is that there are a couple of websites I used to be able to get, and I can't get them anymore. One of them is madisonjazz.com. And one of them is the City of Madison. And I've searched the registry for Madison Jazz and can't find it. I've searched for the text of those words. I figured if it was in a program that's blocking me, it would be somewhere, and I can't find it. I searched the whole hard drive. And I'm sort of at a loss as to where to try next.
So what comes up when you try to go to those sites?
Page cannot be displayed. And I have another computer. I have a laptop. And I can find it just fine on that. So it's and similar software.
Yeah, I just dialed it in and found it.
Yeah. Do you have...
That's weird.
Have you changed any of the security settings on the browser that you're using?
Not that I know of, and everything else comes in. I mean, I go to a lot of websites, and everything works just fine. That's... And it's just a mystery. I just discovered that the ci.madison.wi.us doesn't work either. And it had been working, I don't know. I can't tell you when, because it's been a while since I looked at that. But I know it had been working on the same computer.
Do you clear the which browser? Are you having problems with one browser only or two browsers?
Well, I only use Internet Explorer.
Okay. What I would recommend, you know, just to have another browser on your system in case one fails, to be able to test it, you know, with another, is getting something like Firefox, Mozilla, Opera. There are a number of them out there. But have you cleared the history?
I do it several times a day.
Okay.
Firefox is just another browser. It's not an operating system.
Correct. Yep.
And is it Firefox.com to find it?
Yep, or Mozilla.com, M-O-Z-I-L-L-A.
Any reason to pick one over the other?
It's really one and the same. Mozilla was kind of a code name for a playful Godzilla-like structure that Netscape was going to take on the giant Microsoft. So that's why they use Mozilla.
Yeah, somebody else suggested that. I use WebRoot. It's just, I think WebRoot is the software. SpySweeper. WebRoot is the company. SpySweeper is the blocker. But I use it on both computers.
Right.
And I searched through it, and I couldn't find anything. And when you start looking at people, they all point their fingers at somebody else. They say it's not me.
Yeah. Another thing I would try to do. Have you used? I've used Internet Eraser, and also Easy Cleaner, and you know some people have emailed me and said that they've had problems with Easy Cleaner. So when you use these things for the first time with like Windows XP, which has been around for many years, you can set up a restore point if you have problems with it, which means it goes back to as if you hadn't even installed it. I have links to them on the InfoStar Virus Info Center page.
Okay.
So if you look under Utilities and also Spyware, you'll find Easy Cleaner and also Internet Eraser. But those might erase enough files, temporary files, that there might be something that's just getting in the way. And, you know, just might clean up your system enough to get you back on track.
What gets me is it seems like I should be able to find the string somewhere in searching my hard drive.
And, right.
And I can't. It's, I don't know where it could be if it's not on my hard drive. So that's the mystery. I did try Easy Cleaner?
Right.
And I installed it months ago, and when I go to see if there's updates, it keeps saying there are no updates, so I'm not sure that it's doing a whole lot, but I've run that several times, too, in trying to solve the problem, and that doesn't do it.
I would, you know, check with your security settings, you know, and just, you know, I would probably set them, you know, low so everything could get through and see if that, you know, just making a change like that and then trying it and then changing back and see how that works. Sometimes just changing something from what it is to, you know, refresh in some of the settings might work.
Yeah, I'll give that a try. That sounds like a good idea.
All right.
Great.
Good luck, Jared.
Okay, yep. Thanks.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bob in Winona, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hi, Larry and Peter.
Hi.
I have a USB problem.
Okay.
Let me give you a little background. I was having startup problems a few months ago, and so I was going back to safe mode. And I was able to do some things, clean things up eventually, and I put in a flash drive and was saving some files because I thought I was probably going to have to change computers. And for some reason or other, it started working again. I have XP with Service Pack 2. And so everything started to work, and I was have a printer also on a USB port. But then a short time later, both the serial port, just both the flash drive and the printer have problems. And I can't get the flash drive to work at all. The printer, by unplugging and replugging, occasionally I'll get it to work for a short time. I've tried to thought about putting new drivers in. When I check at the Microsoft website, they said that what I have is current.
Mm-hmm. Probably what I would do is I would make sure both the flash drive and the printer are disconnected from your system.
Mm-hmm.
I would shut it down.
Okay.
I'd bring it back up again, shut it down again, bring it back up, and then attach your printer to it.
You do that twice?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really?
So in other words, you shut it down the first time after you take them off, and then you bring it back up, and then, you know, bring it to a desktop and then shut it down again for the second time. So it really thinks there's nothing attached to it.
Well, you know, I kind of think that I have done that for a while. When things weren't working, I thought that I had it disconnected.
Okay.
But so I'm not sure. I might not have.
Right. So that's one thing that I would do, and then I would add them one at a time. The other thing is I would, if that doesn't work, I would delete the printer and then reinstall it.
Yeah, I did that one time.
Uh-huh. When you deleted and reinstalled it, did you do it all in the same setting, or did you delete it and then shut it down and then bring it back up?
Probably the same.
Yeah, see, I would delete it, shut it down, bring it back up, shut it down again, and then reinstall it.
Okay, I could try that.
You know, I would give those two things a try. The flash drive, try and see if you can use it on another system just to make sure that it works.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Because what happened, when I put that in, absolutely nothing happens with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that... I know this morning I put my flash drive in my laptop, and it said I need to scan this because I'm having a problem with it. But it recognized it, and then after it scanned, it said, you're fine.
Oh.
But you're telling me that you're not getting any reaction at all.
None at all.
And that's
not
typical.
It doesn't even recognize that there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would try, just check it out, make sure, you know, confirm that it works on another system.
Okay.
Just to rule that out.
Good luck.
All right.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's turn to Rick in Green Bay next. Rick, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I need help. A while back, I decided to do a reinstall of XP. It had been about a year and a half, and it was giving me various problems here and there, and I said, well, I'll just reformat the hard drive. I reinstalled XP, and I downloaded all the Windows various updates, security updates, and all that sort of thing. Then I found that about half the time when I click on Internet Explorer, the icon I'm using, IE6, it wouldn't open. And I'm going a little crazy. I checked Task Manager under the Processes tab, and I could see it sitting there. And it had a memory usage of about 12,000 to 13,000 kilobytes, but it wasn't opening. And I'd click a couple more times on the icon, and then it would open. Not that one, but another instance would open. And I could see that the memory usage for that was about 50 to maybe 80,000 kilobytes. So this other one's coming partway. It stalls. When I shut down the computer, if I close everything and I go to shut down the computer, it'll kind of hesitate and give me a message that there's an open IE Explorer and it's closing automatically. And it's this other one that kind of hung in there that I ignored. I've tried running WebRoot Spy Sweeper. I don't see anything there. I've tried turning off the Spy Sweeper and turning off the Zone Alarm, seeing if they're hanging it up, and no changes. And just for comic relief, waiting to call you guys. I tried something yesterday. I thought I'd do a repair or kind of an upgrade install of XP over that other one to see if something got missed when I did the install.
Right.
Well, didn't fix that, but it did make a situation where it won't download any upgrade, upgrades or security things from Microsoft. It just gives me a message that they're ready and click on them, and I click on it, and it says failed with an exclamation point, like it's real proud of itself. So I figure, do I have a boat anchor here or what?
So you were still using Internet Explorer 6.
The only reason I was using 6 was it just seems like every time somebody upgrades something, there are 5,000 extra features in Windows that I don't want, and they get in the way, and 6 in the past had always worked.
Yeah.
Maybe I should try going to 7.
Yeah. Something worth. Do you have access to another system where you can download files or burn it? You know, burn a CD so that you can bring it to your system.
Well, I can get access to the internet. If I click it a few times, it will open up, so I can do that on this computer.
Okay. Well, one thing that I think I would try with your system, you know, set a restore point. Mm-hmm. If you go to, I don't have it posted today, but you could do a search on it. Is Microsoft Windows XP Service Pack 3 release candidate. They recommend, you know, it not being used for your primary system and doing backups and so forth. I've done it where I've installed it and then uninstalled it, you know, using a restore point. It's a 336 meg download.
Okay.
So you could download that file to your system if you have, like you said, you have access to the internet.
Okay.
You could download that file and then run that on your system, and that installs all. It looks at what is on your computer, and it puts in whatever patches and service packs it needs to bring it up to, you know, the most current version.
Okay.
So that might be worth trying.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Windows XP SP3, huh?
SP3 release candidate.
Okay.
If you do search on that, Service Pack 3 release candidate,
okay,
you'll probably find the link. Later to, I don't have my top 10 posted, but it's number 11 in my top 10. Because it's not an, you know, it's not your typical .com or ORG address. It's, you know, one long address that I link to.
Okay. Okay. And do you think I ought to, I don't know if that would relate to the Internet Explorer problems. Should I just jump into 7?
It would take you to 7.
Oh, okay.
It would bring you completely up to date, including Internet Explorer 7. And Internet Explorer 7 basically is brought the Microsoft web browser to where it should be versus everybody else.
Okay.
In other words, access to tabs, multiple homepage startups, which people find very useful. You know, if you have like maybe 5 or 6 popular home pages you want to start up with, it works quite well. I wouldn't make it like 10 or 12 because then you'll be sitting there with, you know, twiddling your thumbs waiting for things to load.
Great. I don't need that. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
I'll try that. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Rick, for calling. Appreciate it.
You know, that might be something to help people with, you know, some USB things, but I usually try to check the devices out in that case. You know, you're talking about hardware. In this case, it's more of an operating system issue.
Yeah. Yep. Jerry in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Peter. I'm usually a lurker, but I think I can help out the caller, two callers ago, who was not able to get to certain websites.
Yeah.
He may have a bad query stored in his local DNS cache, and he could clear that out by opening a command prompt and typing in ipconfig, that's like Internet Protocol config, space, / flush DNS.
Let's see, ipconfig. What's the rest of it again?
Space, and then / flush DNS. That's like flush the toilet.
Yep.
Plus DNS, as in domain name system. And that will clear out all of the stored queries that normally are there to speed up access to sites that you've visited in the past. But sometimes you can get a bad one stored in there.
Good suggestion.
That can happen sometimes. The symptom is that you can get to some websites, but not others.
Yeah. The trick here, if you click on start and then run and then type in CMD so you can get to the command line to run that. So that what it does is it opens up our infamous DOS window on the Windows system. And then you type in that command and that'll do that.
All right. Thank you.
Hope it helps.
Thanks, Jer.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Dan in Osseo, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Peter, I just want to say I appreciate your program, and every time you're on, I love to listen to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a hardware question for you on external hard drives. I'm in the process of buying one for backing up files for both home and office use, and I've heard that there are different formatting systems, and I've tried to research these and just been confounded and confused, so I'm curious about what should I be looking for there, and types. And also, I think you talked about this one other time, but storing digital pictures, they get bigger and bigger, and is it best to store them on CDs, or should I be looking at a better external hard drive for external storage, and how many times should I back them up?
Great questions. Well, one of my questions back to you would be, you know, in terms of amount of space that you need. You can buy terabytes now,
yeah.
And it's amazing how much things have come down in price. In terms of digital pictures, you know, cameras, almost like the de facto standard now is like a six, seven megapixel camera. Whether or not you really need to be taking pictures at that level, versus you are taking pictures at that level, and that's what your pictures are. They do take up a lot of storage space. So I would store them to a hard drive, and I would probably burn DVDs. And, you know, if they're really important to you, you probably want to have multiple DVDs, and you need to store things in a safe place. I always tell people, wherever you feel good, that's where digital media feels good. You wouldn't want to leave it in your car, you know, to be exposed to the extreme temperature swings and humidity swings. You wouldn't want to be using your computer while you're sweating because of high humidity. So, you know, your computer should be as comfortable as you want to be. And then as far as, storage, put them in a fire retardant, storage place that is well protected. You don't want to put them next to magnets. You don't want to expose them to dust, so you should keep them covered up in jewel cases or, a loose leaf that has, jackets that protect them. But getting back to, hard drives, for a lot of people out there, it's probably something where you want it to be easy. So the manufacturers have made things like One Touch, where you click on something, and if you identify where your pictures and music files and important documents and data files are located, and you click it, then it'll back it up for you. companies like Seagate, MaxStore, I think, what is it called, My Storage, or, you know, there's different, you know, cute acronyms for these storage companies. But in terms of comparing feature by feature, you know, you're going to find places like PC Magazine, CNET, will probably give you your best reviews in terms of editor's choice and, you know, describing functionality and specifications and so forth. FireWire connection, there's two different FireWires. The latest one, I believe the throughput is like 800 megabits per second throughput. USB 2 is not quite as fast, a little bit more popular. You know, FireWire was a standard that came out for video, really for video and the music formats because of the high capacity for, you know, video, you know, DVD size files. The one that I use at work, that work and also at home, is a little bit more expensive but has more features. And the features are things like remote accessibility. I install a client on a network workstation, and I can put it on 10 or 20 network workstations, and all the data files from all those workstations are backed up. And that product is called, it's a network attachable storage device is the acronym, and the product is called Mirra, M-I-R-R-A, and it's made by Seagate. So I could remotely access through a website to access my files both at work and at home. So there are, you know, features like that that may or may not be useful for you but may be useful for others. But, you know, those are other considerations. So if you have a family on a network and you have, you know, three people in the network or five people in the network, you have this one remote network attached storage device, and you install the client on all the workstations, and whenever a file is downloaded or changed that they want backed up and they identify it as such, then it's backed up and they can all have the remote, you know, access. So if one of them goes off to college or school or travels and says, hey, I need this, they can log in and grab it. It's a way of sharing pictures to family members. And so the list goes on and on. So hopefully I didn't make your choice, you know, more difficult, but a little bit easier in terms of features that you might need to consider.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Dan. Appreciate it. Peter Greenham, InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant with us today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking computers with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, Larry Mueller here. We'll get right back to the phones, and Steve in Kewanee has a computer question for us. Hi, Steve.
Oh, hi, guys. Great show. Here's a question on logging out of secured sites.
Okay.
My son told me that one has to log out or else you're still connected. I always just X out and go on to other things. And he says that if you do that, you're still logged in, and it could be compromised. Any thoughts?
It depends on the site, but probably the general rule is to log out.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There are some services out there that if you don't log out, they think you're still logged in.
Uh-huh.
So
could that be compromised? I mean, how could somebody else get into that? I mean,
you know,
computer hacks just looking to get into these places or what?
You know, the likelihood of it being compromised is, you know, probably a fraction of 1%. But, you know, with the possibility being there,
mm-hmm.
you know, the good practice is to actually log out.
Sure.
You know, where I work, we have a site where we have a service we pay a lot of money for, and multiple people can log in. And my first experience was years ago. Was, you know, make sure you log out, because if you don't log out, the other users can't get in.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, it tells you that if you just exit out of it, I think even the drop-off on that service was like 20 minutes, to log out of it.
Oh, so it takes that long for them to drop you.
Right, yeah. So
there's a 20-minute window that you are vulnerable.
Yeah. I wouldn't say, it's probably very extremely unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
Places like banks, financial institutions.
Well, yeah, that's where the secure logins are, Amazon and,
So, places like that, they're used to those, people just cutting off. I would not say that those are the situations that would be compromised. But the general rule is to log out and not exit off, because you're not communicating with the website that you're off. You're just, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just telling you the general rule is to, it's something that you log into, you should log out.
I suppose it's good advice.
Yeah. with your computer, you can switch users, you log out and switch users.
Sure.
When you shut down your system, you're logging off. Yeah. But you're also shutting down all other operating functions. You're not just logging off of the system, you're shutting down computer services and so forth,
mm-hmm.
which is the next level. So it knows that you're logging off of your network if you're accessing the internet and you're no longer a node on the internet, because whenever you log on to a network and the internet is a network of computers, you're a node. You're a temporary node. You're a temporary workstation. You have a temporary address that is assigned to your system by the internet service provider. They are another network node. They are allowing you access through their systems. But when you take your computer to the point where you're shutting it off, you're going to the next level of logging out, which is
okay. So
you're done.
So then, if I'm at the bank and then I finish the bank and shut the computer down, then it quits the connection anyway.
Correct.
Cool.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
Thanks very much for calling. I have a story to tell you. My wife got a phone call at work, and she got a call from this online company, and they said they were checking to see if her watch that she had ordered, had she actually ordered this watch, because they had her name and home address and a credit card number and her work number. Her work phone number, but they were sending the watch to Phoenix, Arizona.
Wow.
And she said, no, I did not order that. And so we canceled that, of course, and then got online and canceled our credit card, and nothing else came up. But we were trying to figure out, she does a lot of shopping online and so forth, and wondering how someone could have gotten name, address, credit card number, and work phone number.
Hmm. I don't know all the trails in terms of, people being online, but if you happen to be doing a transaction and it wasn't what you thought it was and then backed out of it, that's one way. Where, you carry it to a point where you're doing the transaction, then decide you don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that information is captured by one of these, botnet kind of functions.
Oh.
So some of the websites that they call malicious websites are set up to capture that stuff. And if you don't apply the patches, these security breach mm-hmm. patches that they tell you about, that would be another way for them to get access mm-hmm. to that information. The other thing is occasionally I have received letters from financial companies that have told me that, somehow their files got, hijacked and, you may want to check your credit report, to see if it's still intact. And I go, oh, that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
So
you never know. it really is hard to know, and nothing else had been apparently attempted to be charged on it. It's just, and it really wasn't an expensive watch. It was a $50 watch, you know, so you kind of wonder.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is related to canceling your credit cards and being a participant in the online world. I had to cancel our credit card, and a word of caution is that if you use your credit card for renewing online services or things
yes.
that you are accustomed to, make sure, you know, you have a list of those. Because if you don't keep up with, you know, reminders and so forth, and I happen to be in a position where I was so busy with work that I wasn't paying attention to being badgered by one company that said, hey, you need to renew, and you need to renew, and by the way, your credit card's expired or doesn't work, and you need to renew, and it went past that time, and it ended up costing me a few hundred dollars to correct the problem.
Ooh.
Because I had to rescue some things that I still wanted, and it was because of changing from an expired credit card or one you canceled.
Yeah, we're aware of that, but that's a good – I'm glad you brought that back up, because that's good for anybody to know, because we have several things that are paid for monthly
right.
via credit card.
Yeah. And
we do it to get the air miles, you know.
Yeah.
that's why you do it. But, and we haven't gotten our new credit card yet, so it's going to be – close on a few things.
Cashola, Larry.
Yep, it'll be cash. Marvin Menominee, your turn. Hi, Marvin.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Let me tell you what's going on. I have Windows XP on my desktop, and the other day I tried to do a restore, and it goes through all the motions and all the stuff, and starts up, and says we were unable to do the restore. And I tried that several times. I also disabled Norton and tried it, and still. And I know I have restore points out there and all that stuff. I'm wondering if that's something you've come across often or if there's something I'm just missing.
So what prompted the initial want to restore?
What was it? Oh, I have a program on here called Sound Soap that takes audio files that you might record or old, whatever, music, voice, whatever, and then cleans it up. And I was running that, and it was working just great, and then all of a sudden I got an error message, and it shut everything off, the programs I was running. And when I started SoundSoap again, I get the infamous Windows message that something has gone wrong with the file you just opened, and...
Mm-hmm.
So I can still run SoundSoap if I just push that Windows warning window over
mm-hmm.
and run that. But I thought, well, I'll just do restore and get back to the day before this happened. And,
right.
And then I keep getting the no can do.
So when you bring your system up, what does it say now? Or you can't get it to a desktop?
Which one now?
When you boot up your computer now. What is it? Where? How far does it go?
Oh, it works. Everything works perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just could not do the restore, and it goes back to the current state, and I'm right where I began.
So it still has the Sound Soap, and it still has the problem.
Yep, Sound Soap doesn't work, and yeah, it just can't do a restore. It says it just sorry, can't do it. Doesn't tell me why. I can click on the further information button and get the huge log, memory dump log, and all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
which is meaningless to me.
Right.
And so on.
So it sounds to me that you've got an error message is related to Sound Soap that needs to be corrected, plus you can't get your system to restore. For some reason, the Windows restore function's not working.
Correct.
Okay. What I would probably do is I would focus on trying to fix the Sound Soap problem. Have you done any searches as related to the error message that you get?
Well, no. I did uninstall and reinstall Sound Soap.
Okay.
And I get the same thing happening.
Right. Well, That error message, is it one that's got like a bunch of numbers, you know?
Here, I'll bring it up right now. I happen to be right here. Okay. It's the Windows. It says Sound Soap on the blue bar.
Mm-hmm.
And it says Sound Soap has encountered a problem and needs to close. We're sorry for the inconvenience. Please tell Microsoft about this problem and that standard message they put out there. I can click on debug, which does nothing. I can click on send error report.
Mm-hmm.
And I can click on don't send. I can also click on the highlighted hyperlink there to see what the error report contains.
Right.
And I did that.
Right.
And it says error signature, app name, soundsoap2.exe, and the version. And the module name, quicktime.qts,
mm-hmm.
and mod version. And then...
Right. What I would do in this case,
mm-hmm.
is I would communicate with SoundSoap, and you know, make them aware of the error message and see if they have a fix for doing an uninstall reinstall. And then in terms of XP, I would probably undo the restore and then turn it back on.
Good luck. Thanks for calling, Peter Green of InfoStar, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking computers now with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. Thanks for listening in. Really appreciate it. Give us a call if you have a question at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Pete, you always bring along a top 10 list of great places, websites to go to. And what have you got for us today?
A couple of things before I do the top 10. And that last caller, I just want to make sure that people understand, you can shut off the Windows Restore and then turn it back on and, you know, recreate access points. So what I was alluding to prior to the break was to try and fix the problem with the application and then undo the Windows Restore and then bring it back online, you know, set mm-hmm. it back up and then do it, you know, and then create your access points again in case you have to remove the application. Because you need to fix the problem with the application first, and it sounded like there was a glitch with, you know, the Windows Restore. I had a glitch trying to get this stuff posted to the web, so I promised to do this later today for the top 10. So these are going to be new to everybody. I'm the only one that set eyes on them. But if you go to InfoStar.com and later this afternoon click on Current or the Top 10 Archive, you'll have access to it. Now, this first one is called TheAirCar.com. So it's TheAirCar.com. And it's a company, the company name is MDI, Motor Development International. The company was formed in 1992. The specs on the model called CityCat is to clock out at 68 miles an hour with a driving range of 125 miles on a full supply of air.
Air.
Now, get this. They made a huge announcement. Their business model is to license the technology for other companies to build the cars. They don't want to be the builder.
Okay.
They want to do the research, development, the improvement, and then license other companies to do the building. In larger volumes. India has a car company that has signed an agreement, Tata Motors, to build approximately 6,000 cars to cruise the streets of India during this year, this calendar year. So
on air.
Anyhow, there's videos and everything that I've linked to online. Pretty neat that, you know, we're moving, hopefully, but nothing for this country. All right. Number two is Zula.com. It's a new web-based web internet video search engine, similar along the lines of YouTube, and it's in beta. Number three is a website that publishes up to 10 stories each day about innovations trying to save the planet, such as like the air car. It's called ecogeek.org, so ECOGEEK.org. This next one was created by the challenge was created by Michelin in 1998, and it's an event for promotion of sustainable road mobility and to foster in-depth understanding on the latest advances in vehicle technology to become more fuel efficient and cleaner and safer and so forth. And if you want to, so this is kind of like the behind the scenes of where all this stuff comes from. And it's called Challenge by Bendum.com. So it's challenge and then BIBENDUM.com. And the last one took place in Shanghai in November of last year. And if you haven't been to NationalGeographic.com recently, awesome pictures, videos.
It's a great site.
It's just phenomenal. So I encourage you to go there if you haven't been there. This next one is called, so number six is SoftwareTipsAndTricks.com, tech support resource you might find handy. They have stuff on Service Pack 3. This next one is a resource for business owners. They claim since 1995. It's called toolkit.com. So one word, toolkit. And they have more than 5,000 pages of free cost-cutting tips and step-by-step checklists and things like that. Number eight is an internet shopping tool called sortprice, one word, .com. So sortprice.com. And I put a couple others up there. And if you're looking at recycling not only cell phones but pagers and PDAs, there's a web resource called collectivegood.com. And number 10, I found one of their utilities pretty handy for undeleting some Windows files that I had mistakenly deleted, wanted to get back. And it's called officerecovery.com. It's a resource of data recovery for software, corrupted files and media, utilities to fix damaged office documents, lost emails, and so forth. You might find it handy. And like I said, number 11 is when I'm going to read this because it's important. It's Windows XP Service Pack 3 release candidate. So it's not their like official SP3. It's a 336 meg download. And I put a caution up there in Microsoft's own words. This pre-release software is provided for testing purposes only. Microsoft does not recommend installing the software in primary or mission-critical systems. Microsoft recommends that you have a backup of your data prior to installing any pre-release software. I've used it a few times. I haven't had problems with it. What they're trying to do is package everything so that if your system is missing a few of the important updates, it will look at your system, it will find it, and it will do it. And like I said earlier, back up your stuff, create an access point to restore to, and I've done that, and I haven't had problems with it.
All right, so there's the top 10. Let's go, and 11, actually. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. John, hi to you.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I'm going to tell you what I'm looking for, and then I'll tell you why. I'm looking for a way to scan a hard drive for viruses through either a bootable disk or a bootable CD. And the reason is I have a Windows XP Service Pack 2 machine that I left on overnight and was checking email constantly. And in the morning when I woke up, it seemed to be absolutely sluggish. I restarted it. And, again, it just stayed there and stayed there. And I finally brought up the task manager to see what the processes were running and also to check the CPU, and it said it's running at 100%. And in checking on some virus places, I saw that there's a file called SVG host that could have one or two instances running, and they may be legitimate ones from Windows or they might be compromised. And so I tried to get rid of that stuff. Nothing seems to work. In the past, when you bought antivirus software, you sometimes got an emergency scanning disk, and that's the type of thing I'm looking for. I even went so far as to take the disk out of my computer, put it in a USB external connector device, and tried to scan it from a good working laptop, and it still doesn't. I can't get rid of it.
Did you try scanning it from that?
Yeah.
Did it work? Did the scan work?
But it from the laptop, it did, but it didn't find anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And when I put it back into the computer, then again, the same thing happens.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't get to a working desktop that at least will work fast enough to do anything. So I can't scan it from within Windows, apparently.
In terms of downloading, you can download these antiviruses and even trial programs. that they make, you know, like if they have a professional grade antivirus like Avast,
That's what I have. So, I have Avast or AVG, one of those
right,
two.
Right.
And it doesn't find anything.
Yeah.
At least from running it from the laptop.
I would try to, but what my point was, you can download those to CDs.
Okay.
And they may not have like the last patch that they have. And in some cases, you can identify when that file was last updated to their website. It varies company to company.
Okay.
But you can download and burn multiple programs to a CD and then install them on a computer that's not attached to the internet, you know, and scan them that way. And like I said, they just won't have the latest download or updates on them.
You mean I should do that to my laptop, which is working, and attach the other hard drive through USB like I've been doing and scan it that way?
You can try doing it that way. You said, you know, putting it in the system and then just running it from the CD. But if you know how to take it out and attach it as a, you know, a secondary hard drive through the USB connection, I would try scanning it through that. Because
okay,
then you can download the latest updates and scan it that way.
Have you ever heard of it being such that it runs so slow on startup that you can't do anything? That kind of a virus?
I've seen ones, you know, recently. I have a friend of mine that has one, and he's still having problems with it, where it seems to occupy 100% of the CPU. But there's nothing that's been identified, and we've scanned it and deleted.
Yeah.
And it's an older machine, so I don't know if there's like, you know, some kind of bug that obviously lingering that just hasn't been detected, or it's, you know, managing to mutate and, you know, staying ahead of the chase. But I've also been in a situation where the virus or Trojan that got on the system knew that it was being sought out and slowly brought the Tower of Jericho down to make the system just intolerable where, you know, you couldn't use it anymore. You know, you wanted to throw it out the window because it's like put it out of its misery.
Well, would it be possible to reinstall Windows to wipe out the problem?
The problem there, and I've discussed this before, the problem there is that if you have data files and you take them off and they're infected,
oh yeah,
then you bring that, you do all this work and then you reintroduce it again.
Okay.
So what you need to do is painstakingly go through and identify each one of the processes that's running and see which one is the culprit, because there's something that is triggering this, and the only way to find out is to define each one.
Okay.
in the task manager. And I have links to, I believe in my tips page, I think it's 4 or 5 online databases that will identify some of those applications, will help you identify what those applications are and maybe give light to which one is the bad one.
Okay. The SVG host is the one that always appears with about 50% on it, and there's more than one instance of it. And each one says about 50%. And I got rid of one. I've turned it off, or whatever you call that, you know, whatever
yep.
button you do. And that seemed to continue working, but if I ever click the other one, and I never know which one is which because they appear in different places in the list,
yeah.
I click the other one, it says, this is crucial to Windows, we have to...
Yeah, you have to be careful because some of those are actually Windows applications that
right.
are running, you know, via the operating system. So that's why in the tips page, if you look under Windows Startup, and then you'll see links that are in brackets, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I believe, they're numbered. Those are online resources that can help you identify those applications and which ones are the good ones and which ones are the bad ones.
Okay. Yeah.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Frank in Appleton, your turn. Thanks for waiting, Frank. Hi.
Hello to both of you, and thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller, and I'm not a geek, so I'm going to have trouble here probably explaining everything that's going on. But
no, we'll help you out.
All right. I've got a four-year-old Windows XP system. It's up to date with all the patches and everything. It's protected well. And I added some memory not too long ago. I added a DVD writer, and I've added some software. But and the thing runs fine. Everything's fine. But my wife and I use the same desktop, and she says, can you change that ugly thing? And I said, sure, I'll just go to display and change it. And I went in there, and it's all frozen up. I can't do anything with it. I can't change anything. What's wrong?
So can you, if you
write... I can change the resolution. I can change the screensaver under display, but I can't touch desktop.
So if you right-mouse click and then click on Properties... You familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah. You mean when I'm in display or just on the desktop?
Just on the open desktop.
I haven't tried that.
Okay. If you right mouse click on your open desktop and then click on Properties, you should have access to changing virtually anything you want for your desktop.
Okay. Why would that be frozen under display on the control panel? Any idea? I mean, could it be...
You might be locked out of changing that in terms of your user permissions.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, there's an administrative user, which hopefully you are.
Yep.
The other option you could do is you could create multiple users on your system.
Uh-huh.
So you
could have that, and I changed it back to a single, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe that's got something to do with it, I suppose.
So, you know, you could leave one as an administrator and then just add another user. And, you know, you could change the name on the administrator so it says your name and then the other user, your wife, or vice versa. It does, you know, whichever one you're comfortable with.
Well, that's what we used to have, but, you know, we changed it. She said, what's the point? And it boots faster, so.
The point? But now she doesn't like that background.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And you were probably okay with it. What the heck, right?
I'm tired of it, too. It's 4 years old, so.
All right. Good luck.
I appreciate the help very much. Thank you. I love your show.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
Good luck.
Floyd in Milwaukee. On to you. Hi, Floyd.
Hi, Larry and Peter. How are you?
Good.
Hi.
I have a problem with NetSky. It's on the computer. I can't get rid of it. What happened was my virus program expired. I installed Norton 360, and then that didn't work, so I did a different one and deleted Norton 360. Mm-hmm. Nothing is finding it. I can't get rid of it, and it will not let me restore to an earlier time.
Well, NetSky is what you're telling me is the culprit.
I believe it is.
Okay. There's a number of things you can do. Microsoft, I don't know if it's identified as a malicious problem, but Microsoft has a malicious removal tool. What you may want to do, and I don't know if, you know, this alludes to what I described before, where if it knows you're going after it to remove it, which it may or may not, but just to play it safe, if you maybe can get somebody to burn you a CD and then run it so it's not connected to the internet, you know, so your system isn't connected to the internet.
Well, I have another computer. I can do that.
Okay. All right. So, Mike, if you go to the Virus Info Center off of Infostar.com and then go to AV Help, there's, I believe, an MS tool, and that's the link to their malicious virus or malicious, you know, removal tool.
Okay.
You know, that's one thing I would do. I would also go to the Norton site or McAfee and look for, and I have
links.
Well,
at this point, I have the free one that you had on your website.
Right, but what I would do is I would go to, because you're telling me scans are not working. Or it's attempting to block you from, you know, doing this or that. What I would do is go to the definitions, the virus definitions, and I've got links to them at the top of the page. And what I would do is top of the Virus Info Center page, is do a definition search on those, and you might find a removal tool for it. In other words, a specific application that Norton or Symantec has actually created to get rid of it.
Okay.
Because you've identified it. So they may actually have a link to a tool that's specific just for removing that.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
that's what I would look for right away.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling, Floyd. Elizabeth in Madison, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And I was wondering, I'm interested in getting my family photos digitized.
Okay.
And I'm looking for, hopefully, a local or regional service that does it at a relatively reasonable rate, as opposed to one of the big national services where they send it overseas and everything else. Do you know of any such
animal? How many pictures do you have?
Probably in the range of 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
900 to 1,000.
Do you have access to a PC?
Yep. Not at this exact moment, but...
But I mean, something that you would call your own or that you could use?
Yeah, and I've scanned photos. I just don't have enough hours in the day.
Boy, a service that would actually do that, you could probably find ones locally or find, I would almost, encourage you to hire somebody. Would probably be less expensive because, if you go to a company that's going to do that, they're going to have somebody sitting there feeding them a scanner, to scan in each picture. And, if you have your own scanner, you can go through the pictures, and it may take you some time, but you have control over the quality.
Yeah, and I'm proficient in Photoshop, and mm-hmm. I'm, kind of a technical person, so that's not really the issue. It's more the time.
Right.
I've had some of these photos for almost 10 years waiting to be scanned, and I just don't have enough hours in the day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, if you look online, there's services that'll do it for, 30 cents to 50 cents a photo.
Right.
But I called the camera company in Madison, and they said it would be at least $3 a photo.
Yeah.
So it's a huge difference. I mean, if it's something you don't know about, that's totally fine. I just hoping that maybe you did, that you had.
I haven't had experience with that because, I've typically used a scanner to do that stuff. But, what I would check is the Usenet groups, and do a search and see if there are any feedback on services that are out there. Epinions is another good place to check and see, feedback on products and services. Mm-hmm. So I would check that route too.
Or hire some kid.
Yeah, find some, kind of geekish middle school, kid that hasn't learned the value of the dollar yet.
That might be the best way to go.
Yeah, to get some, give him or her.
I was hoping to find...
Yeah.
Someone I wouldn't have to watch over their shoulder.
Yeah, understood. Understood.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Sorry, Elizabeth. I wish we had a better answer for you, but short of hiring somebody or doing it yourself, it's going to cost a fair amount of money.
Yeah, or weeding out which ones you really want to scan in and put those at the top of the list and, just spend a little bit of time. And
I can understand her feelings about time, though.
Yeah.
And speaking of time, Pete, we're out of it.
It really goes fast.
And people can go to infostar.com, of course, and find out the top 10 list later on today. And
yeah, probably check in a couple hours. I'll have that up there.
All right. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks.
Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's always the way it works. Coming up tomorrow... Dennis McCann will be with us. He's a golf nut and a good writer, too, and his stories are collected in a new book. He calls it Rough Stuff. I've had a chance to read a few of the stories. I'll probably finish it tonight, and it's a lot of fun. So we're going to have some fun talking with him about that. And then Gary Knowles, Madison travel writer, is looking for Wisconsin's best towns. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.